I think that just as we're living in a nuclear age, we have grown so tremendously in scientific knowledge, it doesn't seem too much to say that men can begin to awaken to the fact that they haven't grown enough spiritually and haven't recognized their spiritual capacities.
Once something like eating is death, then you've struck at the very heart of life. The enemy of the older radical theories may have been the ruling class, but today the stakes of whether we will reform ourselves into a new kind of human being, a new kind of society, whether we will find selves worth being, the stakes of it are simply life itself.
I am going to read from Book 10 of Plato's Laws today. This is a dialogue that I suspect even a lot of Plato fans have not read. And one of the reasons for that is, I mean, honestly, it's not written in the most engaging way. It is perhaps Plato's last dialogue. And so I know, you know, people have speculated, well, maybe he was past his prime or whatever. The way I see the laws is that this is a book about maybe the best practicable regime, the one that's not ideal. He's having to slog through an awful lot of actual proposals for legislation and for how people will live together in real life. And unfortunately for all of that, all of us, that is that's not as exciting and romantic and interesting as utopian, more utopian ideas like the Republic. That gets us into trouble a lot. So the way I see it is Plato, in his later years, devoted himself to the hardest work, which is to deal with the messy reality of human beings. And the dialogue is actually between an Athenian stranger, so that's that person sort of stands in for Socrates, and maybe he uses that because the opinions therein are not exactly Socrates, but maybe still inspired by Socrates. It's kind of hard to tell. Could be he's thinking of some other figure, maybe himself or maybe Aristotle. Anyway, and then there's a man from Sparta by the name of Megillus and a citizen of Crete by the name of Cleinias. And they are discussing how to build a constitution for Magnesia, which was a Cretan colony. And so this dialogue is about the creation of a mixed regime. So it's closer to the type of regime that Aristotle would have preferred and did prefer, for instance, in his polity. So it's very interesting, and it may not be written like extremely well and super engaging, but if you're into Plato, I think it's well worth a read. And it's his maturest work, if not, then close to it. And that's always important, you know, because it expresses a lifetime of learning. So the question in Book 10, generally speaking, is how to deal with atheism and sort of functional atheism. All right. And so, you know, there's an acknowledgement right near the beginning that that in Plato's view, religion is important for society. Therefore, it's important to be supported by the state and that in the right way. And it's going to come about to realize that he doesn't think his own society does that. No surprise there, that it doesn't support it in the right way. But anyway, the Athenian stranger says up at the top of the right-hand page, no one who believes in gods according to the laws has ever voluntarily done an impious deed or let slip an illegal utterance unless he is suffering from one of three things. Okay, so there's three different sources of disbelief. Either he doesn't believe, just flat out, does not believe in the gods, maybe because he believes only in physical things, for instance, Or he believes they exist, but that they do not think about human beings, the sort of clockwork type God, you know, set the world in motion and walk away. Or he believes that the gods are easily persuaded if they are brought sacrifices and prayers, so the gods can be bribed. These are the three sources of cynicism about the gods or disbelief that can cause people, in his view, to be less, you know, just, basically, because he's acknowledging here that religion should and does, if it functions correctly, to support justice. Down at the bottom, Clinias says, well, doesn't it seem easy to say that the gods exist and to be speaking the truth? And he explains, first, there's Earth, the sun, the stars, and all things in this beautiful orderliness of the seasons. And so he's basically saying, you know, it seems simple to me. You know, the world seems to be set up in an orderly way, and we can see those elements as gods. We can see that there's intention in the universe somehow. A little bit further on, the Athenian addresses his own society. All right, and he says, among us, that is among Athenians, there are accounts found in writings which aren't among you because of the virtue of the regime, as I understand. These are discussions about the gods, some with certain meters and others without meters. The most ancient discuss how the first nature of heaven and other things came into being, and then, proceeding on to a point not much after the beginning, they go through how the gods came into being and how they mingled with one another once they had come into being. It's not easy to pass judgment in the case of ancient writings like this as to whether they have some or other noble or ignoble effect on the hearers. But as regards services and honors towards parents, I at least would never speak of them in praise, either as beneficial or as spoken entirely in accordance with reality. So he gave a short but sweet, you know, kind of condensed notion of the Athenian polytheistic religion there. And, you know, he's saying, I don't know if it really is all that edifying, you know, if it really is very good for young people. Do they do things like respect their elders more as a result of hearing these stories of the gods cavorting in on Mount Olympus and doing all these crazy things? I don't know. You know, I don't praise that kind of stuff. So the Athenian stranger is saying, my society has some wrong-headed notions about the gods, at the very least. And he continues down. On the other page, he says, of people who disbelieve, he says, at least some of them, they refuse to believe the myths which they have heard from their nurses and mothers since the time they were still young children, being nourished on milk, hearing them spoken as if in incantations, playfully and seriously. And they heard them in prayers that go with sacrifices and saw them unaccompanied by spectacles executed during the sacrifices. So they've heard these stories, but they refuse to believe them like he does. Okay, so he's acknowledging this is an issue in my society that a lot of people, or at least some people like myself, just can't believe in these stories that we've been told since our childhood. And a little bit further down, he says, let some preliminary speeches the following proceed without spiritedness for those who are thus corrupted in their thinking, you know, corrupted in the sense that it's hard for them to believe in the gods at all because of you know, their incredulity about the stories. And he says, let's speak gently, quenching spiritedness, as if we were carrying on a dialogue with one such man. Now, this is nice because this is how he would address an atheist, somebody who's decided there are no gods because this stuff is silly. And he says, lad, you are young, and the passage of time will make you alter many of the opinions you now hold and exchange them for their opposites. So wait until then to judge the greatness, judge the greatest things. And the greatest thing, which you now consider nothing, is thinking correctly about the gods and thus living nobly or not. Okay, so as for this kind of atheist, he's saying, let's treat them kindly and just expect that as they get older, as they start to have difficulties and they face, you know, the prospect of death, that they'll start thinking more soberly about the gods, but then they're going to need to be taught the right way. See, so the cause of their atheism is that people teach the wrong things, but the cure is not to like make them believe the wrong things. All right, a little bit further down, the stranger says the other two states of mind, two other types of functional atheism, do remain. That the gods exist but think nothing of human things, and the one after this, that they do think about them but are easily persuaded by sacrifices and prayers. So these are form of, you know, the clockwork type god that walks away after creating things, or the, you know, the god that can be easily bribed. Then a little bit further along, the Athenian brings in this distinction of art or convention versus nature, which is a very typical thing for Plato to bring into a dialogue at a certain point, because people argue about what's natural and what's conventional, with the idea that the natural is the truer. And he thinks that a lot of people have this wrong, okay, that they think what is by nature is conventional and vice versa. He says the gods, blessed one, are what these people first assert to exist by art, not by nature, but by certain legal conventions, and these differ from one place to another. So he's saying that many people who are skeptical about the gods say that the gods were invented by people, and that they differ from one place to another, and that's how you know they were invented by people, because the Egyptians don't believe in the same set of gods as the Athenians, for instance. Okay. And further along, he says, all things, friends, are put forward by men considered wise. All these things are put forward by men considered wise by young people, private men who write prose and poets who explain that what is most just is whatever allows someone to triumph by force. This is the source of the impieties of young people. So the older people who should know better, the poets, the authors, the intellectuals, are breeding the cynicism about the gods. Okay. So they're part of the problem. All right. So the Athenian says up at the top of the page, so what do you think the lawgiver ought to do about this atheism, right? Seeing how these men have been prepared in this way for so long a time. Is he merely to stand up in the city and threaten all the human beings that if they don't affirm the gods exist and don't conform their thoughts to the opinion of that they are such as the law affirms? Is he to say that whoever does not show himself obedient to the laws must in one case die and in another case be punished with blows in prison? So are we going to punish these people with, you know, direct force and force people to believe? And we know you can sense the Athenian stranger does not think this is so, even though that's what a lot of governments do. And Clinias says, not at all, stranger, if there happens to be even some small bit of persuasion as regards such matters. So he would agree, persuasion is in order. And the question is, what kind of persuasion? So further on, the Athenian says, it's likely that at this point, I may present something like the following rather unfamiliar argument. The arguments which have shaped the soul of the impious have asserted that what is in fact the first cause of the coming into being and passing of all things away of all things is not the first, but has come into being later, and that what in fact came later comes earlier. And that is why they have fallen into error concerning the real existence of the gods. And of course, Clinias says, I don't understand yet. Well, he couldn't understand yet because the Athenian hasn't explained it. But he's going to get into, you know, even the laws of physics and motion as he tries to argue that many people have decided the physical things came first and then what we call soul in religion. But he doesn't think that's correct. He says nature, they mean to say, is coming into being connected with the first things. But if soul is going to appear first, and not fire or air, that is, those are elements, physical elements that he's referring to. Earth, water, fire, and air, very common distinction, first made by Empedocles, of the four elements that everything was supposedly made up of. He says if it's not those elements, and its soul that has come into being among first things, it would be most correct, almost, to say that it is especially by nature. So the soul is more natural than the elements. These things are so, if someone should demonstrate that soul is a being elder than body, but otherwise not at all. Okay, so he wants to argue that there's a thing called soul, and that it actually comes before the physical things, the body, the bodies, right, the elements, and everything else, including human bodies. Okay, now here we come to the main stage argument. And I will tell you, I'm going to paraphrase this, okay, because he goes into his Plato's views about how physical things work. And he discusses basically types of motion. And he gives numerous types of motion in an attempt to describe various things like circular motion and linear motion and motion that causes things to build and motion that causes things to decay. And what he's really trying to describe there is that the world is full of motion, things coming into being, things passing away, things revolving, things rolling, things stopping, okay? And all these motions, the scientifically minded person might say, you know, they cause each other, right? And that they are the causes of things. The physical things are the causes of the motion, okay? But yet most of those things are lifeless, right? At the beginning of this, I will read this little part here. He invokes the gods or a god. Okay, he says, come then, if ever we should invoke the aid of a god, it's now that this should happen. At the demonstration of their own existence, let their aid be invoked in all seriousness and holding on as if to some safe cable, let's set forth into the present argument. So he said, this is a demonstration. He's going to give a demonstration of the God's existence. And so he goes through this discussion of all these types of motions. And then at the end of that, he says, so then haven't we enumerated in forms all motions except for two? Clinia says, which two? He says, those two, my good man, for the sake of which just about our entire investigation is now taking place. So this is what we're talking about. This is what we've been talking about, Clinias. Speak more clearly, says Clinias. I totally sympathize with Clinias. Athenian says, presumably it was for the sake of soul. Certainly. Athenian says, let there be a motion that is capable of moving others, but incapable of moving itself, and that is always one. And let there be another that is always capable of moving itself as well as others, in coalescences and separations, growths and the opposite, generation and destructions, another one in motion among all the motions. Let it be so. So then the one that always moves another and is transformed by another, we will set down as the ninth type of motion. So there's eight here. This is the ninth. And the one that moves itself as well as others in harmony with all actions and all experiences, and which is called the real transformation and motion of all beings, this we will call just about the tenth, by all means. Which of our roughly 10 motions would we most correctly judge to be the strongest of all and especially active, says the Athenian. Clinias says, presumably it's necessary to declare that the one capable of moving itself differs 10,000-fold and that all the others are later. Athenian, well spoken. So then shouldn't one or even two of our statements just now be incorrect and be changed? Which do you claim are so? What was said about the 10th was pretty incorrect. How? It is first in generation and in strength, according to reason. And the one that we have after this is second to this, though it was just said strangely to be ninth. What do you mean? the following. When we always have one thing transforming another and this another, will one of such transformations ever be first? How will that which is set in motion by another ever be first of the things that are altered? It's impossible. But when there's something that, having moved itself, alters another, and that another, other another, and thus thousands upon tens of thousands of things moved come into being, what will be a ruling cause of all their motion other than the transformation of what has been moved itself? Clinias says, what you've said is very fine, and there ought to be an agreement to these things. Okay, so what has he basically said? He said that we've got it all wrong in the order of things. The physical things don't move themselves. They didn't come first. There has to be a first mover. So he distinguishes, there has to be a source of all motion, and that is a thing that can move other things but is not moved itself by anything else. And then second to that, there is a type of thing that comes into being, and he calls it elsewhere alive, and it has soul. So the first thing, the first mover is a soul. It is the soul, right? But then creatures such as human beings and maybe animals, it's not clear to me here, who have wills of their own, who can move themselves and not simply be moved by other things like something knocking into them, causing them to move. That is soul. They have soul. Okay. And he's saying that soul is what is like the first thing and ought to be ranked first, not ninth and tenth. So the last should actually be first. Okay. The first mover. And that to complete it a little bit further here, he says, let us go on to speak in the following way, and again answer ourselves. If somehow all the things that have come into being should stand still, as most of those men dare to say, which then of the motions mentioned would necessarily come into being first among them? Doubtless the motion that moves itself, for it would never be changed by another before it, there being no prior change among them. Therefore, we will assert that the motion which moves itself, since it is the ruling cause of all motions, as well as the first to have come into being among things standing still, and the first to exist among all things moving, is necessarily the eldest and the strongest transformation of all, while the motion is that is altered by another and moves others is second. So this is the first mover, which we might equate with God, but it's certainly not a Judeo-Christian or monotheistic God as we would conceive of it exactly. However, it is the source of all things. It is the unmoved mover. And then at the very least, human beings fall into the second category, which is that they are moved, as in they come into being not through their own will, but by being created. So they are, literally physically created by other motions, right? And ultimately not able to, create something out of nothing, motion out of nothing. However, so they're not the first cause, but they have will and they can move themselves even when something else external doesn't move them. This is what Hobbes tried to disprove in his physical arguments. But anyway, so here we have Plato's argument for a first mover, an argument for the priority of soul over matter, and a reordering of the whole like physical equation. And remember that this is what people in his society should be taught, and in this new society that they are helping to create the constitution for. If citizens are skeptical and they have become cynical, they are to be taken aside and reasoned with. not be threatened and thrown in jail or worse, but to be reasoned with. And it would seem to me that he's saying that if they can come to believe in the type of mover God that he is reasoning about here, that they will be in good standing. All right, so at any rate, this is a shortened reading of Plato's Laws, Book 10, of the most important parts. It'd be interesting to hear what you guys think. I'm looking forward to teaching this in session, in my last session of More Real than the World, Ancient Insights into the Nature of God. If you enjoyed this series and you want to view the entire class, we can do that for you either by ordering the class itself or just join us on Patreon, and you will gain access to this and all of our other recorded and live courses.